Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome to Connecting Faith. This is Bill Arnold, along with George Fraser, sitting in today for Neil Stavem. We're so glad you're with us today. George, you know, when it comes to replacing your transmission, we would not be the guys.
No.
When it would come to getting a family of raccoons out of your garage, we would not be the guys. Correct?
Correct.
When it would come to raising a barn like the Amish, we would not be the guys to do that.
Oh for three.
However, given our guest today, we have Barbara Kofer-Stoffen. She's written a book called A Very Fine House, A Mother's Story of Love, Faith, and Crystal Meth. And as our listeners may or may not know, we host Real Recovery on Sunday nights at 5 o'clock, which is a show about recovery from addiction. And I think we're up to the task of talking to Barb today.
Oh, we're going to find out. It's an exciting story, Bill. And that's the great part of hosting Real Recovery. We get to see what God is doing in people's lives where hope can kind of get lost.
That's a
good time to tie in on that.
I was going to jump in there, but
you know, that would have been
good. I thought maybe you were going to say something else more interesting.
Well, you know better than that. So I think the great thing about doing this gig is we get to see what Jesus does in people's lives all the time. And there's a war out there. There's a lot of destruction. I look at John 10:10. You know, the enemy seeks to devour, but Jesus said, I came to give you life and give it to you abundantly. And that's what we're going to hear about today.
We are. And this is a very deeply personal account of a mother's story and family that got turned upside down by her daughter's descent into meth. And George, you and I work with people that have gotten involved with meth, and it starts once and it's downhill from there.
It's a one and done deal.
Once you
pick it up and you use it, you're hooked. From what I hear, I'm a recovering cocaine addict, as you know, Bill, and I never did meth. But I'll tell you what, the guys that I talked to that did it, it changes your life instantly. Interestingly enough, it changes it right away, but Jesus can do that too, and that is the solution.
Right. So we are going to get right into our discussion today with Barb Stoffen. Barb, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Now, one of your endorsements comes from Heather Kopp, who is the author of Sober Mercies, and we've had Heather on Real Recovery twice, and we just love her.
Love Heather.
Yeah, just love her.
And, yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah, and I started reading your book and was just captivated. You write beautifully.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
so you. This involves your beautiful daughter, Annie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how does she feel about you, first of all, writing this book?
Well,
where is she today?
She lives in Bend, Oregon, as I do.
Okay.
And she's doing very well. In fact, this month she will celebrate 8 years clean.
Fantastic.
That is great.
Which is fantastic. And I never, never could have imagined her life could be this whole and complete and that she would be this amazing woman today. The miracle of recovery, I tell you, it's really something.
George and I, we talk about Philippians 3:10, that I may know him in the power of his resurrection. And I think this is a really a clear example of true resurrection power when a person is really in the pit of despair and drug addiction. And something as addictive as meth, and they come out of it.
Right. I think it is a resurrection story. And you asked, you know, how she felt about me talking so very openly and candidly about her life and about our family and, you know, our collective journeys through this. When I first sort of felt this nudge from God to write my story, I went to her and her husband, and I said, you know, what do you think about this? And, you know, they were excited. They were very cute. You know, at the time, I guess they were 4 years clean. I started writing 4 years ago. And so they were very excited and said, go for it. My son-in-law said, go for it, Barb. Don't hold anything back. So that's what I started doing. So then fast forward to a couple of years later when Zondervan acquired my story, this all got very real, and both of them were feeling slightly panicked. And so we had a few discussions about it, and, you know, Annie tells me now that when I first got her permission, you know, in her mind, she's thinking, oh, isn't this precious? Mom thinks she's going to write a book, and, you know, we'll each get one. And the fact that it has become something that so many people are interested in really does bless her, and she's proud of me, and she's very, very excited for the opportunity for our story to help other people.
Well, it kind of cements her recovery a little bit, too. If somebody's going to write a book about my recovery, I better stay in it then, huh?
Well, yeah, there you go. And she completely owns it, you know, where she is and what she did. And she's proud of who she is today, as she well should be. So she is fine with me talking about it. She doesn't, at least for right now, she's not putting her face on it so much. But, you know, she has her own life. She and her husband have a business. But she is very, very open to having me talk about it.
I think what's cool, Bill, on these recovery stories is it's not Annie's story or Barb's story. It's really God's story about what he did in their lives. And when we read these and we hear about them, we keep hearing how we might have not have sought this out, but the victory that comes makes the journey worth it. Yep. Have you found that, Barb?
Absolutely. Starting down this road, you know, my hope and prayer was so much that my daughter would just quit using drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And she has become so much more than someone who has quit using drugs. And recovery, as you well know, is about so much more than that. It's really about changing who you are, because as my daughter would tell you if she was sitting here right now, is that you take away the drugs and there's still me. I'm still here. And you need to learn the coping skills. You need to learn a completely different way of doing life. I never thought she had the strength to do that. And it's been extraordinary to watch the transformation in her. And she tells people that it is definitely a story of hope and a story of what's possible.
Well, there's the idea that when something gets taken out of your life, a replacement has to happen.
Right.
And if the replacement doesn't come in and that space stays empty, you're going to have opportunities for relapse pretty quickly.
Right.
When I was reading your book and I was just in the introduction, I have to tell you, my stomach literally flip-flopped when I was reading as to how you discovered she was involved in using drugs. Because
right.
It was a nice, lovely dinner and you guys were trying to have some nice mom-daughter time and you were asking
Easter Sunday.
Easter
mm-hmm.
Sunday, yeah. I mean, what a beautiful day. And you're asking questions, and you had heard in the news about meth use. And, of course, you approached her with that, assuming that she was never going to be involved with something like that, but not ruling out the fact that people around her might be interested in that. And you thought you'd get the classic eye roll, oh, what do you think I am, Mom, stupid?
Uh-huh.
And she looked straight into your eyes when you asked her about meth, and she said, too late.
Right.
And I have to tell you, Barb, my stomach completely flip-flopped when you were on Easter Sunday clearing the dishes, getting that news from her that she's involved with meth.
Mm-hmm. It was life-changing, of course. I had this vision for what my family was going to be and the kind of mother that I had been and still was. And as many of us, you know, we try and create these wonderful close families, and we do, a lot of us, whether we want to admit it or not, we really do have a vision for our children and who and what we want them to be. Drug addict was certainly not on my list. And I wasn't really even thinking in terms of, quote, drug addict yet. I just heard that the word meth in the context of my daughter using it, and what I had been hearing in town is that, oh, gee, this is a substance people don't come back from. This is the ugliest, most vile thing out there. And I almost immediately started to experience her as being gone. Yeah.
Yeah, meth often rhymes with death. I've seen it happen a lot.
Yes.
I lost six guys last year that I've worked with in recovery.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Five of them were meth.
Wow.
So, yeah, it is. It's a horrible, horrible addiction, horrible drug for sure. Tell me about your family life before, you know, I try to do this kind of quickly, but give us a picture of what family life was like before the news on this Easter that she was using meth. I mean, you sort of...
Well, through the years, you know, I like to tell people that, you know, we were the family this could never happen to. You know, we were the Cleavers, for anybody out there who still knows who the Cleavers were. You know, the Leave It to Beaver family. And my husband and I have been married a long time. It's going to be 34 years this year. We were very attentive parents, very, very involved in all aspects of our kids' lives. I'm a Christian. I took my kids to church every Sunday. They were involved in Sunday school and then youth group. You know, I thought I was dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's and doing everything right. Crazy to learn that addiction can really happen to anybody. I never knew that. I thought addicts were those people over there on the other side of the tracks who were bad people, who couldn't control themselves, and that it really was a kind, we do have a tendency to kind of have moral judgments about addicts. I think that's changing. But like I said, you know, she was this bright, beautiful, talented girl with tremendous potential. She was sort of an underachiever academically, but she didn't party. She didn't carry on. She very rarely got in trouble outside the home. We had a pretty nice family. It really changed right before I started to see a change in her right before high school graduation when she experienced her first drink.
Well, if she was a little bit of an underachiever, she'd get along great with George and me. So we're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have more with Barb Stoffen. You're listening to Connecting Faith. This is Bill Arnold and George Fraser sitting in today for Neil. We'll be back in just a minute. Possibly enjoying your lunch, having a nice relaxing cup of coffee, maybe looking out the window going, oh, summer is over. But it'll be back in the spring, summer. Isn't that right, George?
Hope.
Hope. It's, we have always hope.
We're talking, that the Doors? Summer's almost gone. Great
yeah,
song.
So. Yeah, it's a great song. We are talking to Barb Stoffen today. She's written a book called A Very Fine House, A Mother's Story of Love, Faith, and Crystal Meth. And when we just were talking about the Leave It to Beaver house, George, this really great family, great job, great everything. Everything looks really good.
Barb always wore a dress in the house all the time.
And with the pearls
every
meal.
Pearls,
and, yeah, for every meal. So we're so impressed already.
We'd be like Eddie Haskell
totally,
on this.
Totally, yeah. Well, that's a lovely house dress you're wearing, Mrs. Cleaver. All right, George, you have a question for Barb.
Okay, so Annie, a little bit of an underachiever, but not a big party animal in high school, and she starts drinking as senior year. Can you take us on the progression of that? Were there, you know, there had to be some progression, I'm assuming.
Yeah, what happened, she went out with a girlfriend. It was a couple of months before high school graduation, and Annie was sort of socially anxious, and she really didn't. She had friends, usually a boyfriend, and that's another part of the story too, in terms of relationship addiction. But she had this first drink, and I get a call from her boyfriend this one night that she was going to be a little late for curfew, and she comes home, and Annie is completely drunk, and I'm thinking, well, okay. I guess this was bound to happen at some point. Most of us experiment with alcohol at some time or another. I certainly had. We talked about it the next day, and I thought, gosh, you know, in a 2 or 3 months, she's going to be headed off to college. What she told me later, years later, about that first experience is that first drink registered in her brain in such a way as, this fixes everything.
Yep.
It made her less anxious. It made her more comfortable. It made her feel like less of a loser, and she was in no way, shape, or form any kind of a loser. But internally, what I never really kind of realized about Annie is she carried this belief about herself, and it's certainly not something she got from us. is that she wasn't enough, that she wasn't enough of so many things. And I think many of us do this in the teenage years and into adulthood. We have a tendency to compare our insides to other people's outsides, and we don't match up. And she was definitely doing that, thinking she wasn't near as cool as anyone else. And drinking just seemed to fix a lot of things for her. And she got real good at it really fast. And she drank a lot her freshman year of college. She just did not have the coping skills when she went away for her freshman year of college. And we practically pushed her out the door. We thought, this is good for you. This is what you need to do. We, you know, her dad and I both grew up and flourished in college. It was not true for her. She didn't make it through the first semester. She had a major crash and burn, and we had to go fetch her. So very, very quickly, alcohol became a huge problem for her. And she even admitted that to me that first year. She goes, I'm thinking I'm not doing so well with, you know, with drinking. I said, well, stop. And that, of course, didn't happen.
Were there any actions taken, Barb? Did you get her assessed, or did you just figure she was going through a phase and she'd grow out of it?
Yes, the latter. At no time did I ever really think in terms of alcoholism. Even though my dad had been an alcoholic, I didn't understand addiction. I would have thought that I was, you know, pretty hip to all of this kind of stuff, but I really did not understand it. I really felt that she would mature, she would grow out of it, as I had. And it was just going to take a little bit of restraint and self-control and a little bit of growing up.
That's pretty logical, Bill. That makes sense.
Totally. I think there's the reality and the perceived reality. And there was probably Barb, part of you living with perceived reality, which is this is just a phase and she'll grow out of it. And kids have done it before.
Right.
And we'll move on.
And she also, she had a history of depression when she was in middle school. She had a depressive episode. And, you know, I kept a close eye on her all through her teens. And she took an antidepressant kind of on and off. And that's what I was really honing in on. I thought it was a symptom of her depression, which it was. But I didn't see it as a problem in and of itself. And so I kept thinking, we need to manage your depression. You need to take better care of yourself.
What was the next red flag that came along?
She came home, went to our local community college for about 18 months, did very well, taking really hard classes in calculus and physics and chemistry and all of this stuff. And
that'll cut into your drinking, those kind of classes.
Yeah, she. I started to suspect that maybe she was experimenting a little bit with marijuana at that time. I know she was dating a guy at the time who used a little bit of that. But she seemed really pretty high functioning. She got her own place here in Bend. And then when she felt like she was ready, she transferred to a major university again and then went to the University of Oregon. Well, almost immediately, things started falling apart. We thought she was ready, but it was a repeat of freshman year of college, and she just wasn't doing well. And after a couple of quarters, we had to go fetch her again. We brought her home. We did have her assessed at that time, but not for substances. We were focusing on what we were perceiving as depression, maybe another kind of mental illness. And her physician seemed to think that she was bipolar too. And then we sought the counsel of a psychiatrist here in town who confirmed that. But all the while, when anybody's asking her about substances, you know, all she's saying is, no, I just drink a little bit. So that's where our focus was for quite some time.
And I don't want to catch you off guard with those questions, so if you don't want to answer it, feel free not to. But at that time, for you as a parent, was it preferable for her to have a depression problem than a chemical dependency problem?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I can see where you're going with that question. I don't think so. My
Good,
dad had been an alcoholic.
I can't, I was, but, yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of us, it's a lot more acceptable that we have, you know, maybe a little depression problem, but anything but being a drug addict or alcoholic, and it doesn't sound like that entered in the equation.
It's just not where my brain went at the time,
okay.
And it wasn't sort of, ooh, you know, let it not be that. It just it came from a place of being really naive, I think, and I was pretty heartbroken thinking that my daughter might have bipolar disorder and
sure.
what that might mean for her future, because for some people, it can be quite a job to manage that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I just really didn't know. And as things evolved over time, when she did this other crash and burn, and then at the University of Oregon, and then she took off for Arizona with a boyfriend, and she did a crash and burn there, and she had to come home. And when she came home that time, nice, sweet Annie, albeit sort of dysfunctional Annie, really wasn't so nice anymore. We really perceived a change in her behavior. And the entitlement, and she just wasn't nice to us. Something was really changing, and something really started to change in me, too. I'm thinking, you know what? You don't get to treat us this way. And the helicopter mom that I had always been about providing all this room for Annie to kind of be who she was and to try and figure out her life, I started drawing some boundaries in a way that I hadn't before. I was very late in doing that, by the way. Drawing some boundaries in the home, and here she was almost 21, and she's complaining about some of the rules and some of the things her dad and I were asking her to do. And I said, you know, you don't have to be here. Feel free to move out and get your own place and get a job and figure it out. But, you know, if you're going to be here, I demand some respect and some accountability, and you don't get to be out all night without telling us where you are and what's going on, because I'm not going to worry about you like that. So we started having discussions like that, and something in me was kind of starting to change too, like I said. Ultimately, after she was out all night once partying, didn't call, didn't return my calls, when she showed up at noon the next day, kind of with this arrogant defiance, I said, okay, you have a week to find another place to live. Which
here
was
comes
not
the tough
me.
Love.
Yeah, I was not that mother before.
No, you were channeling somebody else, weren't you?
yeah, and, you know, addiction, I mean, anger kind of helps you get there. She was completely floored, and I really think in retrospect, kind of brokenhearted. You know, here was this girl who had forever been the center of the universe, and our son too. I mean, I have a wonderful, wonderful son that I haven't mentioned yet. And to have her say, you know what, you don't get to live here anymore. I think that was very, very hard for her. And she took off. We didn't hear from her for a couple of weeks. I was brokenhearted. I was worried, and of course, wondering if I had done the right thing. And you don't know what to do. You really don't know what to do.
Yeah. So we don't even know what to do right now. So we're all in this together, Barb. We're talking to Barb Stofan. She's written a book called A Very Fine House. It's a mother's story of love, faith, and crystal meth. And this is so hard to get your arms around, because you, as a parent, are heartbroken, sad, scared, frightened, and we want to talk about what all this is doing to your faith. But we are going to take a little short break. And if you have calls and would like to participate in the conversation today, give us a call at 1-877-933-2484. That's 1-877-933-2484. I hope you're enjoying your day and your lunch. I'm glad you joined us today. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Faith Radio. Connecting Faith. Hope you're enjoying today's show. We're talking to Barb Stofan, and she's got a gut-wrenching story of her daughter slipping into meth addiction. And Barb, right before we went to break, I was wanting to find out what happened to the foundation of your faith, or what happened to your relationship with God. And I'm sure you were confused, angry, panicked. What were your emotions? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, I was certainly all of those things.
Okay.
Yeah. When I realized the magnitude of the problem, and that my daughter was using meth, and that this young woman that I loved almost more than my life itself, I was devastated. And I think any other parent going through this knows that it does feel like a death. When you lose your child to addiction, they kind of are not kind of, they are no longer who they were. Their brain is hijacked by this illness and by the drugs, and the behaviors that you see, it's so outrageous, and no way did I ever think anything like that could happen to us. And I'll tell you what, I was really angry with God, really angry. I was in a wonderful church family that supported me during this time, but I was trying to figure out, you know, I raised my kids in the church. I thought I had done everything right. I thought as a Christian, I would be somehow immune to this kind of thing. And my thinking was, you know, God, how could you let this happen? How could you let this happen to me? I used to go into the garage by myself and scream and cry and rage at God. I started smoking again. I hadn't smoked for 20 years, and it felt sort of strangely comforting to be hurting myself in that way with cigarettes again. And so I'd go into the garage and rage at God and smoke cigarettes. And until one day, there was this day when I was out there pretty much at the end of myself. I guess I would describe it as my bottom. Pretty much at the end of myself, on my knees, asking, what do I do? What do I do? Just tell me what to do, because I am so completely powerless over this. I had been trying to chase Annie. I had been trying to fix it. I had been trying to make her stop. And, of course, none of those things worked. And I really felt God speaking to me that day. What welled up in my spirit was, give her to me. Give her to me. And that's what I did. And there was this spiritual transaction that took place in the garage that day. I think I even extended my arms into the garage. Here you go, you know. And for a mother to do that, you know, we are the fixers. We are the rescuers. We want everything to be okay for our kids, and we want to protect them and keep them safe. And I had to be so completely sure that I was unable to do that. And what followed that event in the garage was a feeling of freedom and of weight being lifted off my shoulders in this very profound way. I had never really experienced God that way before. And you know that bumper sticker, the 12-step saying, let go and let God, I'd always seen that before. I didn't know anything about the 12 steps. I thought it was an evangelical saying that was on people's cars. And, you know, when you'd see it, you almost want to go beep, beep. You know, I didn't know it came from the 12 steps. And I really experienced the power of that that letting go thing that people talk about, because it freed me to be able to move forward. Now, there's a tremendous amount of faith that goes with that, too, which I had been praying for more faith, because God didn't say, give her to me and I'm going to take care of this and everything's going to be fine by next Thursday. You know, that didn't happen. And so it is stepping out into faith, knowing I don't know where she is today. I don't know how to fix this, but you are God and you are able. I don't know what you're going to do with this, but whatever it is, it's probably going to be better than what I could do with it. And I very much considered the possibility that Annie might die and that might be God's answer. And I tried to prepare myself for that possibility, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, God has never looked the other way or been caught by surprise when adversity strikes. And mm-hmm. It's really comforting to know he's in control of adversity.
Well, Bill, you know, when she was talking about that in the garage, about Give Her to Me, I could feel that, couldn't you?
Me too.
How powerful. And I think what happens to us at certain moments in our life, the let go and let God, we're powerless over everything. We don't realize that. You know, our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God who is in control of everything. And, yeah, you realize at that moment the real spiritual experience for a lot of us is, I control nothing. God controls everything. That's the let go. And you know what? We might not get an outcome that we like. And that's a little frightening too, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. This experience with my daughter really did reveal to me the myth that we have any control at all. We can't really save our children. We can teach them the best we can. We can equip them the best we can. But in the final analysis, their life is not up to us. The outcomes are not up to us.
And Barb, the more you love your daughter, the more you hate the addict in her. I would guess.
I did hate the addict in her. Yes, I certainly did.
Because it truly wasn't her, and it was something that was causing her destruction and ruin. And I think that's pretty typical. I mean, the more you love someone, the more you hate the self-destructive addict that's in them.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And things got worse before they got better. And, you know, we went through a period of time where Annie was arrested repeatedly. She broke into our house. She stole family jewelry from me. And, of course, the heartbreak of that. And how could my daughter be doing this to us? And during this time, I kind of threw myself into education. I learned everything I could about addiction. I got help. I started going to Al-Anon, which was life-changing. I was also involved in a support group here in my own town with other families whose kids were meth addicts, and we found out they all knew each other. They were all kind of running together, and that, you know, meth addiction, that there is, it's not just a drug, it is a lifestyle that goes along with it. And I learned everything I could about it. And I prayed continually. That day in the garage, there was this prayer that was born, which was, God, please protect Annie and free her from this bondage and lead her into the life that you created her for. Because for a while, I was trying to tell God how to do it. And, doesn't that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. God, would you please do this? And I know that Annie is at this certain place today, and would you please go make this thing happen? Well, when I got over that, then it was just, you know best. She is yours.
Mm-hmm.
Please free her. And you know what your purpose for her life is. And I'm going to trust you and pray that you will lead her in that direction.
Yeah. Oftentimes it's, Lord, here's my vision. I assume you'll be cooperating with it.
Right. Yeah.
But,
like,
I mean,
that word.
Are you starting to feel resentment for how this has hijacked your life? I mean, you were just talking about, I go to Al-Anon, I learn all this, I got to study that, I got to blah, blah, blah. This sounds exhausting.
Oh, it was completely exhausting.
Your life has been hijacked.
We were completely hijacked. It was exhausting. I kept waiting for depression, you know, to fall, that, you know, that I was going to get sick or my husband was going to get sick. God, I had friends praying for us. We were praying for ourselves, and somehow we were given clarity walking through this. And one of the greatest epiphanies I had in the middle of all of this was, you know what? I probably have another 30 years of life left, God willing. Do I really have to spend it this way? Do I really have to let my life be consumed by something that is happening to my daughter that I'm not responsible for anyway? And I got to kind of a place of freedom where I gave myself permission to not go down with her. It was a huge turning point for me, that I got to have my life. God had a plan for me. God had a plan for her. And I could love her, and I could help her whenever she was ready to be helped. But I told her that once. I said, honey, I'm not going with you.
Sounds like you got the first three steps there. You couldn't do this. God could do it, and you were going to let him. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say so, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's a victory, too, Bill. We get that in our lives where something happens. That it's kind of like the 9/11 moment. It was never going to happen to us, but it did. What do we do now? Is there a God? I need his help. And as you said, he's not going to go along with my agenda. I'm all in on his agenda. And that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly sounds like you built up a lot of credit with God. You led a nice Christian life and had a beautiful home and you were attentive to your kids and you were equipped to not have anything like this happen.
Was I equipped to not have any of this happen?
Maybe equipped wasn't the right word. I mean, certainly emotionally thinking something like this was not going to happen to your family.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Of course, yeah. Something like this was absolutely never going to happen to us. And so it was figuring it out as we went along. And all I knew to do and what I felt the best course of action was to take was to continue to let my daughter know how very much she was loved, that we would help her. We had a plan in place to help her whenever she was ready for that, because she was living on the street. We hardly ever saw her. Every now and then she'd show up on our doorstep or she would call. But we couldn't even run an intervention because we wouldn't have known where to do that. And the criminal justice system here in our town served the purpose as a good intervention for her. Because she kept getting arrested. And it was ultimately a very public arrest that she had, where she had been at a place where there had been a lot of drug activity. She was spending the night, and the SWAT team swarmed it early in the morning, and she was arrested. And my girl that I raised, this beautiful, brilliant young woman, was named in the newspaper as a transient.
Ouch.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Hmm. We're just going to take a very short break. You are listening to Barb Stofan today. She's written a wonderful book called A Very Fine House. We have one more segment with her. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Connecting Faith on Faith Radio. Your day is going well. Thanks for making us a part of it. Hope you're enjoying this episode of Connecting Faith. Bill Arnold and George Fraser sitting in for Neil today. We're talking to Barb Stofan, who has written a book called A Very Fine House. And it is a story of her daughter, Annie, who got involved in meth. And George, question for Barb.
Well, this is starting to spiral out of control, and we get our name in the paper as a transient. I'm just wondering, what finally got Annie into treatment? What transpired there?
We had planted a seed with her a couple of months before that we had identified a place in California that we were prepared to take her, because we kept asking her, please let us help you. Let's get treatment for this. After that very public arrest, she did call us and she asked for help. And she said, is that option still available for me to go to treatment in California? And I asked her, I said, Annie, you want treatment? You're ready for this? She goes, oh, I don't want treatment. But she said, I will die if I don't, if I don't do something. So we did this coordinated effort with her probation officer and the people in the jail and the judge. She was going to be meeting the judge for an arraignment in 2 days. And we kind of put everything in place, and he agreed to release her into our custody for the purpose of treatment. And when she was let out of the jail that afternoon, my husband drove Annie and me straight to the airport, and we were on an airplane for treatment, and we had it all set up on the other end. But that was certainly no panacea. I mean, that wasn't an automatic fix. Annie relapsed many times when she was in treatment. Even after 4 months, when she was let out of treatment, she was living in a sober house in Southern California, and she relapsed on meth. And what had happened, she and a girlfriend were meeting some guys at a bowling alley, and these two young women in recovery had this brilliant idea that they were going to have a beer. And then one beer became five beers, and within a couple of hours, they were hooked up with a drug dealer and using meth. And that was Annie's true bottom. That's what she describes as her true bottom. She could not believe the progression, how quickly it went from A to Z. And she said it was extremely painful, very, very painful. And she just took a look at it and she said, okay, she was at her fork in the road. I can call somebody else and go get some more drugs, or I can stop. And that's her clean date. It was October 2006. So that's when that really changed for her. And so when she came home after being away for 6 months, she was only 3 weeks clean. And she was still so green. I had no idea really how still fragile she was. But it was regular 12-step meetings that she really, really committed to when she got home, because she hated 12 steps at first. Oh, she thought they were dumb, and she hated going to those meetings. And now she would tell you that it saved her life. And she is still very, very connected to the recovery community. Not as many meetings, certainly, as she used to go to, but it changed everything, the way she thinks, the people she hangs out with, her attitudes about life and about everything. I'm hugely, hugely proud of her. And we have just gotten to a place I never would have imagined. I never could have envisioned her life being as full and as wonderful as it is today.
That is so exciting. We're proud of her, too.
It is.
And I'm looking across the studio, and I'm proud of my friend George, who's at 30 years of sobriety this last September.
Wow. Congratulations, George.
Well,
that's amazing.
Thank you. I give all the credit to God. That sounds hokey, but here's the deal. We
no,
don't want to quit.
Sound hokey at all.
We don't want to quit. I didn't want to quit. I didn't want to do the work. I'm sure Annie didn't. She talked about that. And we see what God, what man did, God allowed for good, and the victories that come. And I'm hearing your story, and it touches me so deeply. I can't imagine being worried about your daughter, Annie, and you did the tough love of, you can't stay here and do that. Well, my dad did the same thing for me. And my dad told me that, I've resigned myself. I'm going to be at your funeral someday. And I said, hey, say something nice about me. And I remember my dad said to me, Barb, he said, George, a real man, if he's truly sorry about what he doesn't do it anymore. And the first time I ever got to tell that story is when I had an 18-year medallion in my pocket and I gave the eulogy at his funeral. So we have a God that is alive, who is interested in us, who loves us, and never gives up on us.
Right.
And the victories that you can have. You helped my recovery so much, just sharing your vulnerability and your heart and what God's done. So I thank you so much for that.
Oh, well, thank you. Part of the purpose of writing this book, well, the main purpose of writing this book is to share some of the things that I learned. And I think the more real we can get about our own struggles in life, it does seem to give other people permission to get real about their life, too, so that people can seek help. And I think in the church, sometimes people are reluctant to do that.
You bet they are.
We're afraid of being judged as being maybe less than or less holy or less spiritual or less godly than somebody else, when the fact remains we're all in various stages of brokenness dealing with something.
Yes.
We're all dealing with something.
Absolutely. And when we are aware of our brokenness, that's when we can yield to God. And that's just a beautiful thing.
Barb, I want to ask how this has expanded your world. I mean, if you buy a blue car, you start driving around, you start noticing other blue cars, you know.
Right.
So now you've made you've taken a step that says, I have a daughter who is a drug addict. I've written a book. Uh-huh. Now, what kind of exposure do you have to other people in your church or your community or your neighborhood as you're becoming more aware of addiction in families? Mm-hmm.
Well, some of my best friends are recovering drug addicts. They are my favorite people. The transformation that happens in a human being who goes to that awful, awful, terrible place and is able to come back, oh, man, some of my favorite people. And I've become very, very involved in drug prevention. I have learned more about addiction than is probably really normal and have a real, real passion for the field. And this is not how I make my living. I own a physician recruitment company, but I volunteer probably an average of 10 hours a week in drug prevention work. I serve on the board of directors of several drug prevention coalitions here in Central Oregon. One of them, we go into middle schools and high schools and talk to kids about drugs. Very often take a recovering drug addict with us to share their story, to make it very personal, to say, you know, I went to this school, I sat in that chair in this classroom, and when I was your age, this is what I did, and this is where it took me. So we're doing work like that. I tell the story at my church, you know, any church that would like me to come share my story, I'm happy to do that. And I just talk really openly about it. It is not a secret. We're out there with it. And I think we're healthier as a result of that. And so it's really kind of become my ministry.
I love that, Bill, because we might hear that in high school and, you know, kind of scoff at it. You know, I don't have the problem. And right away, we might not see the impact of those stories, Barb. But years later, when we need help, we know where to go. And so that's really planting a seed.
I think it does. Yeah, plant the seed. There are a lot of things that have to take place to keep kids off drugs. And part of it is our culture here in the United States. We need to rethink how much we drink and the drug culture in this country. We're truly at epidemic proportions now.
Well, I know I speak on behalf of George because I think we're both watching the Vikings-Packers game tonight. And every commercial...
If I get done with my Bible study.
Yeah, after prayer and repentance, you might watch the game if time permitting.
I got an honesty issue. I lie a lot, yeah.
Yeah, the lie-o-meter is just going crazy in the studio right now. But my point is every commercial we go to is going to be usually an alcohol beer commercial, and it's a big party on the beach, and everyone's having a blast. And if you're not having at least that much fun, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
Well, we've got messages all day long that indicates mm-hmm. that we're not having the kind of fun we should be having in life.
Well, and then
right.
She talked about Annie's first time she drank. You get that magical, warm feeling. Where's this been my whole life? I have my solution now.
Mm-hmm.
And it all ties in.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that's very interesting about alcohol is that it's so enmeshed in our culture, and it's one of two drugs, alcohol and tobacco, that we control in this country. We pretty tightly control it. Yet it still kills more people each year than all other drugs combined. And now we're talking in various states about legalizing and controlling yet another drug. It's, I think with marijuana, what makes us think that, you know, we can do a better job of controlling it than we do alcohol. By virtue of the fact that it is legal, seems to make it seem more okay, more permissible, less dangerous, and the perception of harm goes down.
Yeah, well, this has been a fascinating hour, Barb, and I so appreciate you sharing your story because it's going to be an encouragement to a lot of people, and I want to recommend the book. It's called A Very Fine House, A Mother's Story of Love, Faith, and Crystal Meth. We'll post all this on My Faith Radio website. You go to the show page, Connecting Faith. It'll all be up there, and that you can send this message out. Go to the show page and send it out. Now I know when I got up this morning, I think the station was a little bit fuzzy this morning. Ted, what was going on?
Well, that's in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area where you are. That's where you're listening. And, yeah, we're doing some tower work, so for our listeners here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, be patient with us over the next few days here. We're getting some work done that's just necessary and might have intermittent signal, a little bit scratchy, but it'll be back to full power soon.
But we also have a you can stream it live on the Internet, of
course.
Crystal
clear, yeah.
And the HD radio, which is 98.5-2. You can also go there, can't you?
That's correct.
And things
you got
will be
it.
Squeaky clean, crystal clear. All that?
That's right. That's why we have you fill in. You know your stuff.
This has been a fun time filling in for Neil this week. I know Joe Rathmanner is in tomorrow. Neil's back next week. So this is all for George and myself. George, you're buying lunch, aren't you?
Why does our producer have a better voice than we do?
No, I'll see you later.
He's more talented. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks.